I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday before Thanksgiving, 26th of November. Ann Patchett is our guest this hour. She's an acclaimed, celebrated American writer, and she has a book of really interesting essays. This is the Story of a Happy Marriage is the name of her new book. The beauty of the book, she writes, is how it keeps the past alive. Her beloved dog, Rose, is a puppy again. There is her grandmother, who she cared for, Carl, her current husband, and she are meeting for the first time. They are young with no idea of what's ahead. And if she's lucky, someday in the future, she'll see what she's written in this book and think how young I still was and how much more there was ahead. She's written essays on all kinds of subjects, marriages, her parents, some of the assignments that she's been on in her years of writing for various magazines. And I didn't know where to start, but I think we'll start with her opening a bookstore, because what a great thing to do, to open a bookstore. That's kind of a dream of mine, starting a radio station and opening a bookstore. So this is a collection of essays, and it's really captivating. I like reading essays. Ann Patchett is our guest. She, of course, has written a number of books. She's author of The Patron Saint of Liars, Taft, The Magician's Assistant, Bel Canto, Run, and State of Wonder. She has written three books of nonfiction, the highly celebrated and much discussed Truth and Beauty, about her friendship with the writer Lucy Greeley. What Now? An expansion of her graduation address at Sarah Lawrence, and most recently, this particular book. I'm sure many of you listening are fans and would like to speak with her, and you will have a chance to do that. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Anne. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. I just want to say right off the bat, I think you should open a bookstore. And I think a bookstore with a radio station in it, because, you know, multi-purposing is the way of the future.
Oh, Anne, I can't even do the interview. All I can do is think about that possibility.
I'm going to interview you now. Just relax. We're going to talk about your dreams. This is so exciting.
Oh, boy, what a dream that would be. I just think it's terrific. And not only did you open this bookstore, you're really keeping alive the importance of talking about the importance of independent bookstores.
Yeah, that actually is what I'm doing much more than working in the bookstore. The people who work in the bookstore, and my partner, Karen Hayes, who actually does all the work and runs the bookstore, I think they kind of crack up as I go around the country talking about working in a bookstore, because, of course, I'm never there. I'm always off talking about bookstores instead of, you know, wrapping the books, which is what I should be doing.
Yeah. Isn't there something about them, though, that you just walk in and there you are for hours and... Oh, I love bookstores and hardware stores and libraries.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so true. Every time I walk into my bookstore, I just love it. There's such a great vibe, and I find such strange books. And I, you know, have a much higher than average awareness for what's coming out and what's being published. But every time I walk in, I find some book and I think, oh, I've never heard of that. I've never seen that. I have to have that book.
So how many books do you have in your house?
I have no idea.
Do you have hundreds?
Hundreds. I have thousands. And I have to say, I'm not a sentimental person about books. I give them away. I send them over to the library sale. I get rid of them constantly. My house is also full of books that I don't love, because all the books that I do love are the ones that I give away. So the books that I read that I wasn't crazy about tend to be the ones that I still have.
Well, you need to change your order here and give those away, and then just give the other ones away, but put your name in it and say, sometime, some year, just give it back, huh?
No, you know, for me, because I get so many books and people give them to me and send them to me, I like the idea of them moving on. And in fact, when I really passionately love a book, I will buy 10 copies so that when somebody's in my house and says, you know, I'm getting on a plane, I don't know what to read, I've got the book for you.
What a nice thing to do. That's a really nice thing to do.
Well, I'm in the book distribution business.
Yeah.
In all senses.
Right. Every now and then people tell us things You know, we all have teachers who told us something and it really changed our lives. There's yeah. another profession that's underrated and so important. I love this discussion because this is so to the point. Russell Banks, one of your teacher,
yeah.
who you had a conversation that he subsequently didn't remember, but you described this as a single conversation that changed everything you did as a writer from that day on. What a thing to say.
And well, it's absolutely true. And I think that there are moments in our lives when we can hear, when the right person tells us the right thing, that it's true, that we can recognize it as true, and we can implement it. You know, I'm going to be 50 a week from today.
Happy birthday.
And thank you very much. And probably you could walk up to me and tell me the truest thing in the world, and I would be like, whatever. You know, I don't have that openness anymore. But when I was 20, I really took things to heart, and I had a very good ear for what was true. And Russell Banks, who just has a fantastic book of short stories out right now,
oh, does he?
Permanent Member of the Family, which I love. Russell Banks, when I was 20 years old, was my professor at Sarah Lawrence, and he said, "You're really talented. You know, you're not going to get a lot of feedback in class. You're really good, but you're shallow, and you kind of skate on the surface." And he said, "The only person who can make you better at this point is you, and you have to ask yourself if you want to write great television or great literature." And he said, "There's nothing wrong with writing great television. That can be a great life, and of course." This was 30 years ago. Now, of course, writing great television is writing great literature, from what I hear. I don't actually watch television, but I hear it's very good now. I hear it's a whole different world. But it really was like being struck by lightning, and everything changed. And I thought, I really want to be good, and I really understand that the only person who can make me better is me. And I think if you're an athlete, if you're a musician, no matter what you do, if you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, you get to a point at the end of your schooling where the only person who can really stay on your case and push you is you.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
And I think at one point, it must be one of the essays on writing, that you give the advice, which is really true of all those professions, too, that we all get stuck at times. You don't want to go to work. You want to sleep in. You're kind of tired. You're not feeling terrific. But you, as a writer, that you just sit there. So you've got a writer's block. So you sit there. You sit there for 20 minutes. You sit there for an hour. Sit there for a couple hours.
Right. And, of course, I don't believe in writer's block. I think that when you get stuck or tired or bored when you're a writer, you say, oh, I have writer's block. Whereas if you have any other job in the world, you're just stuck or tired or bored, and you work your way through it, or you lose your job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my husband's a doctor. He doesn't get to have doctor's block. If a patient comes in and he doesn't know what's wrong with that person, he does research, he runs more tests, he talks to other doctors, he tries very hard to figure it out. And sometimes he can't figure it out. But the idea is, you don't say, wow, you know, the gods, the spirits, the muse, they've blocked me. You say, this is a hard problem, and I'm going to have to work hard to solve it.
Well, now that you've mentioned your husband, we'll have to talk about Carl for a while here.
Carl. He's not here. We can talk about him.
Oh, good. He's probably not listening, because here we are in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Are you in Tennessee?
I am.
All right. That story is really amazing. First, we'll get back to how you spent 11 years with this guy who wanted to marry you and you just didn't do it. But the story, when you get on this airplane, this horrible blizzard, to go to Minnesota where Carl is and there's something wrong with his heart, and then miraculously it changes. It's an amazing story, isn't it?
It is an amazing story. And you know, it's so funny with life how you can have these amazing stories in your life and it doesn't occur to you to write them down, you know?
Mm-hmm,
it's
right.
Just sort of, that's your life.
Right.
And when it came time for me to write this piece, and I had a commission to write a really long piece, and my friend Nikki Castle, who was so responsible for everything in this book and putting the book together, she said, oh, write a piece about how you and Carl got married. Write a piece how you decided after 11 years to get married and how you're happy. But as I said, Carl's a doctor, and he decided to go to the Mayo Clinic to have a checkup, which I thought was weird. He'd never done that before. And he said, well, every time I plan to have a physical, I wind up not going. I get busy, I cancel, or I go sit and talk to my friend, and you know, we don't get anything done. And the only way for me to really have a physical is to leave town. So I said, I'll come with you. And he said, no, no, stay home. It's just going to be a day. And there was something wrong. And he went up and he failed one of his heart tests. And he was going to have a cath. And I said, I'll come up the next day. And there was a terrible blizzard. But as luck would have it, I was on the last plane that made it in to... Is it Northfield, Minnesota? I can't remember where the Mayo Clinic is. Yes, and the whole thing seemed extremely dramatic, and I kept thinking, boy, if I am killed on this little plane flying up here to see if Carl is okay, and he's okay, that's really going to wreck his life.
No, it would have wrecked his life. You're right.
I was thinking very much like a novelist at the moment.
Right.
Boy, this is going to be so ironic.
and so he wasn't okay, but then...
Okay.
Yeah.
And he wasn't okay. And I talked to the doctor, and I looked at the film, and it looked very bad.
Right.
He had a parvovirus, and they said half the muscle tissue in his heart was dead. And I was thinking, that's what comes from hanging out in emergency rooms with sick people.
Aww.
You pick up terrible things. And Carl had wanted to get married really from our first date. He'd been asking me to marry him for 11 years, and I didn't want to get married. It wasn't that I didn't want to get married to him. I didn't want to get married kind of on principle. I just didn't want to get married. Mm-hmm. I had been married once before for a very short time when I was in my 20s, and I sort of swore that I'd never do it again. So we were standing in that airport getting ready to come home, and I said, so I guess when we get home, we'll get married, because I was thinking, you know, if he needed a heart transplant or something, I would, mm-hmm. we would need to be married. You can't be
right.
helpful if you're somebody's girlfriend, which is why all these same-sex marriage laws are so incredibly important. You know, it's important symbolically for marriage, but boy, it's just important
right.
because we need to have rights to help one another mm-hmm. when we need the help.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got married, which is to say we got a marriage license, and we had someone sign it, and we mailed it in, which counts. I like to say I'm as married as anyone who had a $100,000 wedding. And about 3 months later, he was fine.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, I was upset. I had sold my house. I had signed on for life, but I thought it was going to be a really short time.
And have they ever explained what happened, Anne?
He's done a very bad job explaining. I said to him, we have three absolute truths. One absolute truth, half the muscle tissue in your heart is dead. I saw the film. Mm-hmm. Absolute truth number two, that heart muscle tissue does not regenerate. Absolute truth number three, you're telling me there's no dead muscle tissue mm-hmm. in your heart. So one of these three things can't be true. And he just kept saying, I'm fine, don't worry about it. And the only good explanation I ever got was a doctor who told me that if he had had the tests when the parvovirus was active, that the heart muscle tissue could be paralyzed and not dead.
Hmm.
And that when the virus passed, there was a chance, and in this case seems to be the fact, that the heart muscle tissue was fine. You know, it was the sleeping beauty syndrome. All it took was the kiss, and it woke up again.
You talk about not having written for television, but maybe this is it. You've got this story. You've already got it down. It's a terrific story, and I think that it would make a really fine television drama that you
know,
could write.
I have. The reason I became a novelist, I have no esprit de corps. I don't enjoy working with other people. And everything having anything to do with film is about working together. And people will say to me, oh, you just don't want to see your work changed. It's not that it. That's not it at all. You can change anything you want. Writing for me is not about taking meetings and getting notes and making compromises. I think it's fine. I think it's great. That's just not what I was cut out to do.
Yeah. We'll talk more about what she has included in the series of essays in her just published book. You just heard one of the stories. It's about Carl and how she happened to marry Carl. And to read this story is just terrific. It's a very, very well done. Well, she's a terrific writer. This is The Story of a Happy Marriage, Ann Patchett, and it's a series of essays that she has written, some for some of the publications that she worked for. She did a lot of magazine freelance work, 17 Magazine, where she started and really was on, worked for them for a number of years, Vogue, Gourmet, The New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's. She wrote book reviews, features, and personal essays, and many personal essays on all kinds of topics are in this just released and very well-reviewed book. If you'd like to join our conversation, please feel free to do so. Here's how you do it. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to go there, well, you could, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ann Patchett is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number. And before we go into some of the other stories, let's take a call, Ann, from Mary in Marshfield. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. I was curious if she invited her mother. My daughter did the exact same thing after 25 years of engagement to the same guy. She had a bike accident, and they told him at the hospital that he's at the next of kin. You get her parents here, which is a three-hour drive. They promptly got married. They had their lawyer come over to the house, and they, for a bridesmaid or whatever, they hauled up a plumber who was fixing their water heater. And I didn't get to go. I just wanted to know she let her mother know.
Oh.
Well, it's really funny because my mother lives down the street, and we decided that either we invited everyone or no one, that if we invited, three people, then people's feelings would be hurt. But if we invited no one, it would be fine. So we didn't invite my mother. There was nothing to invite her to. I mean, literally, we have a friend who's a priest who runs a homeless shelter, and he was going to a Kentucky Derby party in our neighborhood, and he came by and signed the papers. And we never can remember when we got married. So whenever we open the newspaper and it says it's Kentucky Derby Day, we turn around and say, happy anniversary. But I walked down the street with the marriage license, and my mother signed the witness line. So she actually perjured herself on our behalf, and then we mailed it in. But I love the idea of the plumber getting to be the witness.
I do, too. Thank you, Mary, so much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Some very tender stories about your grandmother in the book. And you're right, a lot of people are familiar with not a lot of people, but many people are familiar with taking care of somebody who's elderly, and you've really lost the essence of who she was, and you're really taking care of the essentials in her life, clipping her toenails, and that's hard. That's hard, Ian.
It is, and you know, it's funny when you say not all people have had this experience, and I think, oh, but they will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sooner or later, if you are lucky to live long enough, you will wind up taking care of someone, and it really is an incredible privilege. Not to sound Pollyanna-ish about it, but to really explore the parameters of love, and to honor somebody in that way. I have tried over the course of my life, you know, to be a better person or to be a more spiritual person and to meditate and to go on retreats or to pray or, you know, and all of that. Nothing much comes of that. the times in my life I feel like I've made any spiritual progress are the times in my life that I've actually taken care of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that work is sort of the deepest human work. If it's taking care of a baby, or if it's taking care of your 96-year-old grandmother who's dying and doesn't know who you are,
mm-hmm.
That there's some very deep love in that.
Yeah. Your grandmother who would give your dog Rose. I hear your dog Sparky in the background.
Yes.
I love that. That's
Sparky has a play date today, so there's a lot of action in the house.
Oh, Sparky has a friend over, huh?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, but your grandma would give Rose, your beloved dog at that time, part of the lunch sandwich. I like that.
Yes, yeah. She would come over. My grandmother, when she couldn't take care of anybody, and that was sort of her whole life, was being helpful and taking care of people. And then she couldn't really take care of anybody, but she could take care of my dog. So whenever we would go to dinner or go out to the movies, I would drive Rose over and leave her off with my grandmother because it made her feel so good to be able to take care of her. And then she would give Rose, you know, half her lunch or dinner or whatever. And that was great.
Yeah. Let's talk about your mom. Let's talk about divorce for a moment. You found Carl, and of course, as the title of the book would indicate, you've been very happily married. You have a great marriage, but your first marriage was difficult. Your mother was divorced. I've always wondered about the effect of divorce on children. And you write a lot about dealing with your stepbrothers and sister and the impact of trying to see your father in California and your mom's in Tennessee and she's with this guy who enters your life all of a sudden in this huge way. Did it feel like a real discombobulated youth to you? Were the effects of divorce strong?
Well, sure. But, you know, the thing about kids, they're incredibly resilient and you don't have any frame of reference. So the weird life you're living is your life, and you feel like it's just the same as everybody else's life. And honestly, when I was growing up and I had friends and their parents were married, but their homes seemed as strange as mine. You know, every family, that's when you really become a part of it. So I think that when you're a kid spending the weekend with another kid, the parents don't pull any punches. You know, they really are themselves because they forget that there is another child in the house that they didn't give birth to.
Mm-hmm.
So people can be pretty extravagantly strange. And I think that the thing that matters more than anything is whether or not you feel loved. So even though there was an enormous amount of upheaval and weirdness and we moved around a lot and there was divorce and remarriage and some more divorce and remarriage and
right.
different kids coming and going. You know, we were very loved.
Good. Yeah. I'm glad to know that.
Yeah.
And Rose, let's talk about Rose
sure.
for a moment. Dear
yeah.
Rose, I'm with you about dogs. I absolutely love dogs. And eventually I'm going to get a therapy dog because I think nothing better than taking your dog and making people feel better in all kinds of settings.
Yeah.
Where did you meet Rose, and why were you so captivated by this, you know, animal who really couldn't speak to you, at least verbally?
You know, I don't know. Carl and I were in the park in Nashville. We had gone running. It was on a Sunday. And we came back. Carl is a very, very friendly person. And he stopped this girl who was sitting in her car talking to this puppy and said, you know, this is an amazing dog. Where did you get this dog? And she said, I'm trying to give this dog away. I found this dog. I brought her to the park today to try to give her away. So we had plans to meet friends. We said, we want to think about this dog. And then we went off to have lunch. And we decided we really did want this dog.
Aww.
We went back to the park, and the girl had given the dog to somebody else. And she had left. So I found the dog, but not the person who owned the dog. And I lied. I went up to this woman, and I said, you know, that's my dog.
Oh, Anne!
We said we were leaving and coming right back, but we said that we were taking her. And this woman said to me, well, you know, the The woman said someone else was interested, but she said they hadn't committed. I said, oh, it's a mistake. We committed. We want the dog. And she gave me the dog because if she had really wanted that dog, she wouldn't have given it to
right.
me. And I wrote a piece about getting a puppy, getting Rose, for Vogue. I was writing a lot for Vogue at the time. And the piece was very much about the fact that I didn't want children, and that when you get a dog and you love a dog and you're a woman of childbearing years, everybody says you're sublimating
right.
and that you must, in fact, just really want a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very strange to me because I just really wanted a dog. And I wrote this piece, and it was a very, very popular piece. Apparently, it got more fan mail than all the other pieces in Vogue. So time goes by. I stop writing for Vogue, and they call me right after Rose died, maybe 3 or 4 months after Rose died. And they said, you haven't written for us in 10 years. We're having a big anniversary issue. We're trying to get our favorite writers back, and we want you to write the front piece of the magazine. And I said, okay, that's fine. I'd like to do that. And I said, what do you want? And they said, well, the most popular piece we've ever had was the piece you wrote about finding a puppy. So we'd like you to write something like that. And I said, well, my puppy just died. You know, this is 16 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how about if I wrote a piece about Rose dying? And it was so good because if it hadn't been for that phone call, if it hadn't been for that assignment, I never would have been able to write the piece about losing a dog. That was such a hard piece to write because it really shook me terribly when she died. Even though she was 16, even though she'd had a great life, I completely understood this was the end. You know, she'd had a beautiful life. This was the end. It was okay. And yet I was devastated when she died. And it was so hard for me to try and figure out just for myself why was that, that I was more devastated by the death of my dog than I had been by the death of some people that I knew in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a lot of people that had that experience,
right.
and I needed to figure out what to say about it. And so the assignment forced me to figure that out, and that was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had so many people. Interestingly, people have come to the bookstore so often and have said to people working in the bookstore, I've got to find that piece that Anne wrote about her dog dying because my daughter's dog just died, my friend's dog just died. You know, and it's the only thing that made me feel better was reading that piece.
Mm.
And I think, well, then, good. You know, some good has come from life. If I can be of comfort to a stranger whose dog has died, that's a good thing.
Right. Let's go to Marty in Bennett. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
I'm in a book club. There are 12 women in this book club, so you can imagine having all of us like the same book is pretty rare. In the past, The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down was one we all loved.
That's a good choice.
Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse was another one.
That's a good choice.
And, of course, Bel Canto. We all loved Bel Canto. I don't think I relaxed the entire time I read that book. My nervous system was on overdrive the whole time because you knew nothing good was going to
nothing
come
good.
Out
of no,
what
nothing
was happening.
Good.
Wonderful book.
Thank you.
I would actually like to ask you a question about Truth and Beauty.
Mm.
I read that some years ago, and I confess my memory is not really great about books that I read. But I really wonder, why didn't you and your friends take Lucy somewhere to get her some help? And I realize that that's a pretty putting a lot of the onus on you all.
No, I'm happy to answer that
as
question.
As I recall, it was... That was such a hard book to read. Mm. That story was so hard to read.
And for those who are not familiar, you're going to need to briefly outline the story.
Truth and Beauty is a story that I wrote about my friendship with Lucy Greeley. Lucy died in December of 2002 when we were both 39. She'd had jaw cancer as a child. She had 38 reconstructive surgeries over the course of her life. When she was 39, she died of a heroin overdose. She had become addicted to OxyContin after a surgery. And then when that ran out, she went to heroin. Lucy had a ton of help. And she was in and out of rehab. I begged her to come and live with me in Nashville. She tried to make it work so many different ways. She had so many fantastically good friends. I was one of them, but I was only one of them. So there is no part of me that looks back on all of that and think, oh, if only we had done this, or if only I had said that, or if mm-hmm. only we had tried this. We really all did beyond our best, and so did she. She really, really tried. It didn't work, but I don't have any feeling of guilt or regret. I actually really do believe she had such a hard life, starting with cancer at the age of 9, going through all of these surgeries, living through the repercussions of having so much radiation as a child, so that the surgeries never healed and never worked. And Lucy, in a very profound way, was through with her life. Just the suffering and the physical problems. I don't think, in retrospect, it could have gone another way. Mm. I think that if she had been saved that time, as she had been saved so many times, it wouldn't, you know, and in the next 6 months, in the next year, she would have died.
Thank you, Marty, so much for your call. You write a couple of the essays about one of them in particular, a convocation that was given, I can't remember at what school, where you were talking to the student body who had been assigned your book and Lucy's book, which you really liked the fact that those books were assigned together for the freshman class. What school was that?
Miami of Ohio. It's a great school.
Why did they assign those books, and why were you pleased that they were assigned together? Why should they be read together?
Well, I very often am involved in convocation projects at different schools. Almost every year I do one someplace where the incoming freshman class all reads the same book, and then they bring the author in. That's a very common phenomenon these days. And because Lucy had written a book about having cancer as a child and kind of growing up as somebody who looked different, her book is called Autobiography of a Face. And after she died, I wrote Truth and Beauty about our friendship. And in part because, as I knew I could not keep Lucy alive, I wanted to do everything I could do to keep her book alive and to make sure that people going forward were still thinking about her, talking about her, and learning from her experience and from her enormous intelligence. So the notion that somebody picked my book and then said, let's do both of these books together, they're both pretty short. Book clubs very often will read Autobiography of a Face and Truth and Beauty together. Mm-hmm. And it's great because, you know, she was my best friend. So it's like we both have our voice, we both tell our story, and they're great books to read together.
Mm-hmm. The best piece in the book, according to a couple reviews, described your application for admittance to the police academy in L.A. during the aftermath of the Rodney King beating in 1992. Your father was a retired police captain. Would you agree? I think this came from The Guardian and maybe The New York Times. I can't remember that it's one of the best pieces in the book.
You know, not for me to say. I have no idea. They're all very personal, and they all represent different things to me. What's nice to me when I hear that is that it makes my dad happy.
I'll bet it does.
when that review in the Times came out on Sunday, that's what mattered. My dad was thrilled because the piece about him was the best piece. So I love that.
Your father was involved in some big cases, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Sirhan and Manson?
And Manson. He was one of the people who brought Manson in. My father, if you remember the LaBianca murders, the Manson family had two murders that were 2 days apart, the LaBiancas and then the Tate murders. And my father was in charge of the LaBianca murders. And he was the person who realized that the same criminal group had done both of the murders.
Hmm. So was this piece, in a way, Anne, to honor your father?
Yes, it was. I mean, I had wanted to write a whole book about my father and about his career and about the Los Angeles Police Department. And my father was very much in favor. This was 20 years ago when I tried out for the police academy, and I got clearance. I was honest. I was up front with everybody, and my father was all in favor of it. But as I got into the project, I realized that my father didn't want me to write a book. My father wanted me to be a cop. And my father was so excited about this because he kept saying, well, you know, if you're really going to write this book, you should stay on the force for 2 years. And if you stayed on the force for 2 years, then you could go into the FBI and you would be great in the FBI. And I kept saying, wow, Dad, that's not what's going on here. Many things will happen, but I will never go into the FBI. And I didn't want to do this project in order to disappoint my father. I wanted to do it in order to make him happy. And I wound up, after getting into the police academy, deciding to scrap the whole thing, just realizing it was never going to work. And so I had all of these spectacular notes that I walked away from. And then when I was doing the essay book, I found them again and thought, wait a minute, you know, I could write a long essay about this.
Right. What made your father think you would be a good FBI agent?
You know, I think my father would probably think you would be a good FBI agent, too. You know, in the same way that I secretly believe that everybody wants to be a novelist, my father secretly believes that everybody wants to be a cop because he loved it. Right. He loved it. Yeah. It was his dream job. It was the job he worked so hard to get. And he just assumed that if we were all really honest with ourselves, we would admit that we wanted to be police officers in Los Angeles. And because then the next greater glory would be to go into the FBI. That would be what my father would wish for me as the next generation.
And there's a lovely story about his reading you a Christmas story over the phone. It's one of the early essays in the book. It's so beautiful, Anne.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a story. When my parents were divorced, my mother took me and my sister to Tennessee, and this was a different world. You know, where people would get divorced and the wife got full custody of the kids and could just go wherever she wanted to go. You know, fathers really didn't have any rights to their children in 1967 or whenever my parents got divorced. So we lived in Tennessee. We saw my father a week a year, and we talked to him once a month. My sister and I both had birthdays on the 2nd of the month, so we would always talk on the 2nd of the month and then on holidays. And 1 year, when I was some undetermined young age, 9, I don't know, I'm just guessing, my father called me up and read me a Christmas story out of the Los Angeles Times. And it was so meaningful to me because it made me believe that he really understood that I wanted to be a writer. And it was very sweet because no one before or since has ever read me a story over the phone. And it was also a beautiful Catholic morality tale about poor children in an orphanage and gypsies and nuns, and basically had all the elements that I really was looking for in a good short story. And it was a beautiful gift. And of all of the things that I've been given in my life, that story is the thing that has stuck with me. And something that I really hope will happen from publishing this book is that somebody will call me up and say, I wrote that story. Or I remember that story, and I know who wrote that story. I would love to know. I would love to read that story again.
Anne Patchett, our guest this hour, her series of essays just been released, and they're profound and lovely, and it's titled, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. We're welcoming phone calls for her if you'd like to join our conversation. I know it's mostly a listening experience, but do feel free to call if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Anne Patchett is with us now. I want to hear about the experience because I think this is This is really fun. I know it was hard work, and some of it was not a lot of fun. But some of these assignments, when you were a freelance magazine writer, did you come up with where you wanted to go? You wanted to go to a jungle. You wanted to go see opera houses in Italy. You wanted to go live in a Bel Air hotel, you know, take a week off. Did you come up with this, and then they were just fun, these exotic trips that you went on? Or how did that work?
I have to say, with those three, yes. Those were trips that I took for Gourmet. And, oh, I loved Gourmet. That was really one of the only magazines that the day it arrived, I would drop to the floor and read it cover to cover and then make several of the recipes. But I had such a wonderful editor there, and he would just let me do anything I wanted. And I did go on some crazy trips. And I remember once, we always have a lot of house guests. We have two fabulous guest rooms, and it was one of those years that I think 300 nights out of 365, there was somebody else living in this house.
Oh.
And I was talking to my editor, Bill Sertl, and I said, I just can't stand this anymore. I've got to get out of here. And he said, well, do an assignment. What do you want to do? And I said, I just want to be alone. I just want to go to a hotel and be alone for a week, a really, really nice hotel. And he said, oh, great. Where do you want to go?
What an answer. Where do you want to go? And so you did.
And then, of course, there was the RV trip. And that was a funny story. That was for Outside magazine. And that was, there are many ways in which doing a book of essays is a great thing. But I got an assignment to drive an RV across the West for Outside. And I was supposed to write about how terrible it was and how much I hated it and how awful RV culture was. And actually, Carl and I went on this trip, and we had a fantastic time. And I had to write a really stupid article about how bad it was. And it was a service piece, you know, how much Winnebago's cost and how much gas they use and how awful they are. And it was not a good piece. And then when I was looking at it to decide what pieces I wanted to put in this book, I thought, you know, so many interesting things happened on that trip that I didn't write about, because they weren't appropriate for the piece I was writing in the magazine. So I threw the piece out that I had published, and then I wrote the piece that I wished I had written about what was really going on in the Winnebago, the piece I never published in Outside magazine, and then I got to put that in the book.
Wonderful. Oh, that's nice. And you had broken up with Carl, right?
And then
you got back together, and here you are in this RV with somebody you'd just broken up with.
We had been broken up for a while. And I was going on this RV trip. My mother was Carl's nurse. Carl was a doctor, and my mother was his office nurse. So my mother was the one who told Carl that I was going to drive an RV by myself across the West. And he came, and he was like, no, I'm going with you. We don't have to get back together, but you're not going to do this by yourself. I'm going to go with you. And we fought back and forth. But he ended up coming with me. And we got back together during the course of that trip, because either you're going to get back together with somebody after a week in a Winnebago.
Right,
or
that's
kill
it.
Each other.
<It's> right. Or it's over, it's
or
over.
Somebody's going to be hitchhiking back home. And it was such an interesting, adventuresome, romantic, difficult time, and definitely worthy of a story that was not about the price of fuel.
Exactly. I hadn't realized, Anne, that you spent so many years at 17 Magazine, and those were not easy writing assignments, were they?
Well, they weren't hard. How to decorate your locker, and when your best friend's a guy, and when your sister reads your diary. And I would like to say none of those pieces are included in this collection.
Right.
But I did cut my teeth at 17 for about 8 years when I was in my 20s. And whenever people come up to me and say, oh, I want to take a tour of the great opera houses of Italy, how do I get that assignment?
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, oh, it's not a problem. Just write freelance for 17 for 8 years.
Yeah.
Have every bit of your ego beaten out of you. And then you'll start getting great assignments from Gourmet.
Well, it must have been really hard. Is you're having to write, what was it, 1 out of 10 articles would be accepted? That's a lot of writing that never goes any well. You get to write for yourself, but with the idea that maybe it'll be published.
Welcome to your 20s.
Oh.
You know, that's apprenticeship, and that's really what that time was. I was learning how to do it, and the 10th article that they did accept, they would give me so many notes, and they would make me rewrite it 10 times. And every single person at the magazine, from the brand new 20-year-old intern to members of the janitorial staff to the editor-in-chief, got to write on the piece and say, well, you know, that's not the way I felt when I was 14.
Oh,
I don't
my
think
gosh.
This is right. And, boy, I just put it all in. I did it. And that was a fantastic learning experience for me.
Hmm. And which one was the first novel? How did that happen?
Patron Saint of Liars was the first novel, and I was a waitress at a TGI Fridays in Nashville. And I had been teaching college in Pennsylvania. I got divorced. I was 25. I moved home. I got a job as a waitress, and I would make this book up in my head while I was working, while I was, you know, running fajitas or wrapping silverware, or when I came in early in the morning, there was a lot of taxidermy at Fridays. I don't know if this is still the case, but the place was loaded with little dead animals, stuffed raccoons and wolverines and things, and they were way up high on a shelf, and I was supposedly the only waitress who wasn't afraid of heights and wasn't afraid of dead animals. So every morning I would get on the ladder and go 10 feet up, 12 feet up, and with the dustbuster and vacuum the duck-billed platypus, whatever was up there, whatever dead stuffed thing was up there. And because I didn't want to think about it, as no one wants to think about vacuuming a raccoon first thing in the morning, I would think about my novel. That was my comfort. That was my invisible friend and my solace. And then once I had the whole book in my head, I got a fellowship in Provincetown to the Fine Arts Work Center, and I went and wrote it.
And then you got to buy a house, didn't you, when it was published?
No, no,
oh,
that was after
one.
Bel Canto.
I'm sorry.
That was the fourth novel.
Oh,
but that was okay.
Yeah.
That was okay. Huh. It was worth the wait.
I really like reading essays. Do you like writing them? Do you like the fact that you have a book of essays? I like that they're complete and they're, well, not all of them, but yours are complete and they're well written and they take you to different places and then you go on to something else. Maybe it's a result of doing talk shows. I'm always on to something else. But I really like the essay form.
I love the essay form. I love writing them. Because I'm a novelist and I'm usually working on something that takes 2 or 3 years, it's very satisfying for me to write an essay that takes 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, you know, but it has an end point.
Yes.
I love the form. I love reading essays. The problem with books of essays, and the reason why they're so unsatisfying, is that people will have 2 or 3 or 4 fantastically good essays, and then the rest of the book just kind of feels padded out. So it was really important for me to try to write a book of essays that would read like a novel, that would have a theme and an arc and would go someplace. And these are really all essays about commitment mm-hmm. and about things that I deeply love and feel, you know, that I'm married to in a larger sense.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us, Anne.
Oh, it's been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Anne Patchett, our guest this hour. The book is This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And, of course, a celebrated American author, 6 novels, 3 works of nonfiction. She's won a lot of awards, was named one of Time Magazine's most 100 most influential people in the world in the year 2010. She's also co-owner of a bookstore, Parnassus Books, in Nashville, Tennessee, where she lives with her husband, Carl, and their dog, Sparky. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Just a reminder that for those of you who like politics, this book's been getting a lot of attention. Mark Halperin, co-author of Double Down, Game Change 2012, will be with us tomorrow, and we'll also talk about the Native American photography exhibit. It has quite a history, which is at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Thanks for listening.